Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 22nd of March. Considering the day's news events, the terrorist attacks in Brussels, we thought we would devote the first part of our hour to an examination of those attacks. We have a terrorism expert joining us the first part of the program. And then later in the hour, we'll be talking about jobs. Regardless of party, candidates who are running for president like to talk about how they will create jobs once in office. Should we be bringing back a federal public works program like what FDR did? Can a politician really create jobs? Our guest later on in the program, the president of BizStarts, which assists entrepreneurs in starting their own companies, and he did a recent op-ed piece, Presidential Politics and Jobs, a Reality Check, which suggests ways that the government could help people who are trying to start small businesses. We'll be welcoming phone calls, your response to the terror attacks, the first part of our program. Just to update you, you probably know this news, but in case you don't know the update, there were two explosions. At least one was caused by a suicide attack in the departure hall at Brussels Airport. It killed about 10 people just before 8 a.m. Brussels time. And then later, an hour later, an explosion at a subway station in central Brussels, not far from the European Union's main institutions, killing about 20 people and more than 230 other people were injured. 8 hours after the explosions, a news agency affiliated with the Islamic State issued a bulletin claiming responsibility, calling Belgium a country participating in the coalition against the Islamic State. Joining us to talk about the terrorist attacks in Brussels earlier today is Dr. Tricia Bacon, assistant professor at American University's School of Public Affairs. She worked on counterterrorism for over 10 years at the Department of State, including the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the Bureau of Counterterrorism, and the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Her research focuses on terrorist and insurgent groups, alliance behavior and decision-making, U.S. counterterrorism policy, and the role of intelligence in national security decision-making. We'll be welcoming a few phone calls for her. You'll have to call in early for this part of the hour's discussion. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Dr. Tricia Bacon, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Considering all that was happening in Europe, particularly in France, not all that long ago, was there a way to anticipate this kind of horror attack coming just on the heels of that? Is it an intelligence failure that these people were not found before today?
I think one of the troubling aspects of this attack is that it does come so quickly after the attacks in Paris, and it comes in the midst of a heightened security environment, particularly in Brussels since that time. There was knowledge that there were parts of the Paris attack network that were still at large, and concerns about what they were planning next. And upon the arrest of one of the individuals involved in the Paris attack, there was indications that planning was underway. His arrest may have accelerated the plots that were already underway, with the knowledge that if he may cooperate with authorities, which would essentially reveal some of the information about what was planned, people sympathetic or working with him may have accelerated their efforts to conduct these plots today.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like the kind of thing that intelligence authorities would have been looking closely for and trying to track, and their inability to do so is concerning.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what kind of information Salah Abdeslam has given to authorities since his arrest?
We don't have a good sense of some of it yet. There is information to suggest that he was supposed to be a suicide operative in the Paris attacks and then opted not to before fleeing to Belgium. But there was a public revelation that he was cooperating with authorities, which may have precipitated the acceleration of a plot underway. That's speculative at this point, but there is information to suggest he is cooperating.
Are there a lot of terrorist cells in Belgium? If so, why would there be any terrorist cells in Belgium?
There does appear to be a greater problem than was previously appreciated. There has been a disproportionate number of foreign fighters going to Iraq and Syria from Belgium. There's been a marked increase, and particularly high considering the proportion of its population that adheres to Islam. So there was indications that there was problems underway. What we're seeing is a certain concentrated area within Brussels, where there does seem to be a network that has developed. And a lot of times these networks do develop based on things like personal ties and relationships, and this seems to be one of those instances. And one of the concerns is, how large is this network? If the attacks today were conducted by a different network than the Paris attacks, we have a much greater problem on our hands than we realize, because there were multiple cells. If it was the same network, it gets to the question of why authorities weren't able to better identify individuals that were involved in the plot. Mm-hmm. So either scenario is a difficult one in terms of understanding the threat and being able to thwart it going forward.
And when you try to answer the question, why wouldn't authorities have been able to identify more members, why wouldn't they?
It does appear that there is a problem in terms of penetration into the neighborhoods where these terrorists have been operating. The ability to find one of the Paris mastermind in the neighborhood that is very close to his family's home is alarming. That means that he has local support. We don't know how long he was there at this point, but even if he was only there for a brief period of time, he was able to find local support to hide him in that location. This suggests on multiple levels that there isn't adequate police penetration of these neighborhoods in terms of community relations with the neighborhoods, that there isn't adequate intelligence penetration, either through human sources or electronic surveillance, that people could operate undetected, especially people who were openly wanted and being sought by authorities.
And is there kind of a worldwide counterterrorism network that's helping in finding these people, the U.S., France, European nations? Are we all involved in this together or not?
We are all involved in this together, but that doesn't mean there isn't still some problem sharing information, sharing intelligence in the most timely way, especially when it's very sensitive intelligence. But since Paris in particular, I have no doubt that there has been a real increase in collaboration between the different intelligence services in West Europe and the United States in particular. On the other hand, there's also so much noise that's going on, as we say in the intelligence world, when you're just getting so much information that it's hard to sort through it and determine what are the most credible pieces of information versus what is the majority of information, which doesn't necessarily have that kind of value. So it's a very difficult problem when you're in this kind of threat environment to discern what information is the most reliable, what's credible, and how to piece it together.
We were hearing not all that long ago that ISIS seemed to be on the decline, that it had lost some of its status, that there weren't as many people joining ISIS to become fighters. Does this fly in the face of that kind of awareness of ISIS, or do you believe that they are on the decline?
It wouldn't be unusual for a terrorist group in the decline to try and conduct attacks to show that it is still viable, especially when an organization has lost territory, such as ISIS has over the past year. Terrorist attacks are a way to exert power and to terrorize a larger population in the face of decline. So I don't think that this necessarily flies in the face of discussions of the Islamic State's decline. Having said that, it still has a number of foreign fighters, particularly from Western Europe, who, when they return home, may be returning home with the intent to be involved in terrorist activity in their homeland, which apparently was the case in these instances.
So Western Europe, obviously we've seen terrorist attacks in other parts of the world too, but Western Europe has reason to be afraid right now?
I think there's the reasons to be concerned about Western Europe at this point. And until we have our hands around who all was involved in these plots, until we've identified things like who the bomb maker was of these fairly sophisticated explosive devices, until we know where the support network is coming from, I think there's reasons to be vigilant in terms of the threat environment.
It must be so hard to be a citizen living in Belgium right now, or have family members living there, to be on lockdown, for the whole really country to be on lockdown like this and stay where you are, stay in place. How horrible.
Yes, and this is the second time they've had to endure this. There was also a lockdown right after the Paris attacks in the hunt for people who were associated with it. So it must be a very difficult environment. And while I think, as I say, there is reason to be concerned, it is ultimately a problem of small numbers. It's not necessarily a large part of the population overall. It's a very small number, but a very small number of people, as we have seen, can do an extensive amount of damage.
Yes. Were these really large bombs? They created so much chaos, injured so many people, and killed so many people.
Well, from what I have seen, they were well-fabricated devices. And in the case of both the Paris attacks and in Brussels, we're seeing indications that the attackers also had assault weapons. So they're doing this coupling of shooting and bombs to get access to their targets. On the other hand, these were very soft targets. And so the ability to kill a lot of people in environments, especially on a metro station during rush hour, these are intended to be very lethal attacks.
We have time to take a couple phone calls for you. Dr. Tricia Bacon is our guest responding to the horrific terrorist attacks in Brussels earlier today. Assistant professor at American University School of Public Affairs, and before her years at American University, she worked on counterterrorism for over 10 years in the State Department. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at @KDunnShow. We go to James in Elkhorn first. Hi, James.
Good afternoon. I'm just curious about the process of identifying the source, or, you know, someone claims or takes credit for the attack. Who's verifying that? And I mean, it seems pretty quick from this morning to now that everyone's just agreeing or going along with the fact that this is IS. Who decides that?
That's a very good question. What we saw in this instance is there is essentially an ISIS-affiliated media agency that has been releasing claims of responsibility, and often is the first to do so. And it doesn't necessarily advertise itself as Al-Qaeda or as ISIS's mouthpiece, but it is behaving in that way, and it has been able to, in previous attacks, also claim responsibility credibly shortly after the attacks. So in this case, it's in part the agency that released the claim, first in English and then in French and Arabic, that has given more credibility to the claim of responsibility.
Thank you.
Thanks, James, for the call. How do we fight this, Dr. Bacon?
I'm sorry?
How can we fight this?
How can we fight the Islamic State?
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is the million-dollar question. It's obviously going to have to be a multifaceted campaign against the organization, against its activities in Iraq and in Syria, being able to degrade its appeal and its territory there, and also a counter-messaging campaign that eliminates and prevents it from recruiting people from outside of the conflict zone, people who are volunteering to join the fight with them, trying to come up with narratives that dissuade people from that process of radicalization and joining the organization. So it undoubtedly is going to be a difficult and long haul against the organization, as strong as it is at this point, even though it is weakening. But it is a defeatable organization.
And are we, I don't know how familiar you are with our counter-messaging, but I'm sure in your work with the State Department you know a great deal about this. Are we putting together effective forms of counter-messaging?
That has been one of the real challenges in this process, is what a counter-messaging campaign would be effective and who are the effective messengers. I think that there is probably multiple effective messengers that could be delivering these, and it's not necessarily always going to be the United States government. It's going to be other voices in the community. It's going to be other religious leaders. It's going to be people who've defected from the organization and can tell stories of what the organization is really like. So it's a very complex effort to undertake to counter-message effectively and to reach the audiences you're trying to reach. I think we have a long way to go on this, but I do think it's become an area of increasing priority for the U.S. government, so I think we're going to see progress in that direction.
And we go to Dan in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good afternoon. I've got a question. Unless we find out what these terrorists or what ISIS really wants, what's their core demand or need, Hi, good afternoon. Unless we find out what these terrorists or ISIS really want, what the core of their drive and motivation is, it's really very difficult to directly engage them and defeat this enemy, so to speak. So what is your take on what they really want? We know the symptoms. We just saw a very interesting film about London Has Fallen. And although that might be, in some people's eyes, an exaggerated version of what's happening in the world, that's not too far from the truth, because these soft targets you talk about are all just citizens. They aren't fighting our military. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I think there's two parts to that question, and one is, what does ISIS as an organization want? And it's been very clear about what it wants in terms of being recognized as the caliphate and creating a contiguous Muslim state governed by its interpretation of Islam, its distorted version of Islam. That is not, however, why individuals necessarily join the organization. What we see is that people join these organizations for a variety of reasons, and it's not necessarily because that they fully embrace the political goal. They may join for other reasons, such as to be part of a community, for the excitement, for monetary reasons, because their friends have done it. It's a much more complex sort of process to understand why individuals will join these kinds of organizations. And ISIS is trying to create a clash of civilizations. It's trying to pit itself as being a force against the international order as it stands today. So it's going to be very hard to find a way to negotiate or to deal with this organization given its aims.
Dr. Beacon, thank you very much for joining us for a discussion. We will continue the discussion, and thank you so much.
Absolutely. Glad to come.
Dr. Tricia Beacon, assistant professor at American University School of Public Affairs. She, with the State Department, worked on counterterrorism for a number of years, including the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the Bureau of Counterterrorism, and the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Tomorrow, John Munson will be in. We're going on a retreat, our show is. So John will be here to continue the discussion during the 1 o'clock hour. His guest will be Andrew Basic. He is a retired U.S. Army colonel who lost a son in the Iraq War. He's now professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University and the author of a number of books on foreign policy. His latest is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. It will be published next month. We continue and talk about jobs the next hour of our program. We just didn't want to ignore the major terrorist attack that took place in Belgium earlier this morning. And our guest wrote a very interesting piece in the journal Sentinel recently looking at presidential candidates and whether or not they would be able to help create jobs. Obviously a big issue among Americans and has been for some time. He reminds us, our guest, that we had programs in the 1930s, but what do we need now? We'll ask our guest that question, hear his answer, and hear your answers as well as we continue. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour wrote a really good piece in the Journal Sentinel recently, Presidential Politics and Jobs, a Reality Check. Dan Steininger, who is the president of BizStarts, which assists entrepreneurs in starting their own companies, president of Steininger & Associates, he is as well, helping employers identify really interesting and new approaches to driving new revenues for their companies. He is the author of the piece and is our guest this part of the program, and we thank you very much, Daniel, for being on the air with us.
No, thank you, Kathleen, and good afternoon.
It is true that jobs, the creation of jobs that pay well, really a driving, it's probably the number one issue in this country right now, that people need work that pay decent wages. Just generally, do you think that the presidential candidates are addressing this issue the way they need to be?
Well, they're having a lot of fun politically. It makes for great press to say, and each candidate, whether they're Democrat, Republican, socialist, whatever, they're all saying the same thing. I'm going to create jobs as president. Well, for those of us who run businesses, that becomes it's an interesting comment because we've never noticed presidents creating jobs, except if you go back to Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression and started the WPA and the CCC. That's the last time we remember that presidents actually create jobs. So we'd like to – that's why I wrote the piece. We want a reality check. Let's ask them what they're actually going to do to create jobs.
Will any of them create programs like FDR did?
No, they're not going to, and it's not in any of their platforms. So we've heard everything from trade wars to we're going to invest in our future and blah, blah, blah. So we're not getting any real game plan to what it would take and in what way the government could support job creation, and it could. There are things it could do, and that's why I wrote the editorial, to sort of lay out things that the government and any of these candidates could be doing or suggesting to create to address the real obvious anger in America that we're not creating jobs at the rate we used to, and the good-paying jobs. So those are gone.
And tell me where the jobs that are being created are coming from.
Well, okay, that's what's happening in the United States over the last 20 years. It's a huge demographic trust. I think your listeners all know that if they use Google or if they turn to their cell phone or with their software on Microsoft, that the jobs are being created by startup companies all over the country. That's where your biggest job creators are, whether it's Apple, Microsoft, Google, Dell. and what's happening with the larger, well-known, respected brands that we've all become used to, they're actually downsizing because of automation, robots. It's changing the world as we've known it. In a way, it isn't just the manufacturing jobs. It's the service industry. I mean, try making a customer service call on your cell phone anymore and tell me you talk to anything but a robot.
It drives you crazy.
You can check out at the grocery store with a machine. You can right. you go to Home Depot or Lowe's. You can check out on your own now. Basically, most of corporate America is trying to downsize, or in many instances, they've relocated to Mexico, China. I mean, that's a very true statement. You know, here's the New York Times. I'm holding my hand. Your readers can't say, but I'll crink it. Here's the Carrier Corporation. All these workers love their jobs. They were proud of them. They were making $22 an hour. They're very happy with what they were doing, very pleased with their lives. Suddenly, they're told they're indispensable. Their plant just moved to Mexico. And why? So some corporate CEO gets a bigger bonus. It's sad, and they're moving these jobs out of the country. And so what's going to fill that gap? So we need to have an entrepreneurial economy in the United States. We have to create and support entrepreneurs. And that's what these presidential candidates should be talking about.
Mm-hmm. So what can government do to help entrepreneurs?
Okay, the first thing they can do is, I think, and I mentioned people like Michael Bloomberg, who started an incubator in New York to help minorities, immigrants, people who don't know how to navigate the business system. How do you reduce the barriers to starting business? That's something they can do. Second, I think the government itself and our educational institutions can start to teach entrepreneurship, teach the creative part of life. So if we graduate from school with math and language and arts, those basic things, those are the basic building blocks we need. But today's students need to learn how to be creative, how to be innovative. And those are things you can teach in a curriculum, and they haven't been. And there's something that our entire education system is leaving the kids short, because so many young people today know they've seen their parents get laid off, and they said, I'm not going to any. I want to start my own company, or I want to work for myself, or I want to work for a startup. Well, who's teaching them how you start companies? So it's a different world, and we need to react to what's happening, not just in the United States. This is all over. China's automating. Mexico's automating. It's happening everywhere.
Who taught you creative thinking?
Well, that's good, too. When you run a company, and I write a column called Innovate or Die for the Biz Times, you learn very quickly that I'm a recovering lawyer, and I'm a recovering CEO. When you're in business, the world is changing constantly, and if you're not able to creatively think of new ways of doing business, you're out of a job or you're out of a company. So I was forced to develop creative thinking skills in order to survive and as a CEO, have our company grow as a financial institution. So once I jumped out of there, I understood, well, look, there's a whole generation of kids that need to learn these skills, and there's entrepreneurs that need support. That's one of the reasons I started BizStarts. Do you realize there was no place for a citizen here in the Midwest or anywhere to go to get help in starting their own little company? I mean, if you wanted a restaurant, a hair salon, a coffee shop, a daycare center, where would you go for help? So we started BizStarts. It's located in Schlitz Park, and you just can go online. Anyone wanting to start a company can go online and type in BizStarts.com, and they'll already instantly get help to how to start a company. They can apply online. They'll meet our executive director, Jacqueline Davidson. It's like going to see a doctor. She's going to help them every step of the way, connect them to mentors, entrepreneurs. Finally, we have a place where our citizens can go who want to start companies. So, I mean, for anyone out there listening, you want to start a company because you just lost your job, go to BizGuards and we'll start helping you.
And it still is an American dream, isn't it, to do that?
If you go all over the world and you ask any citizen of any country, is it a good idea to start a business? 90% of the countries of the world will say that's a horror story. Australia, Canada, and the United States, those are the only three countries on the globe. If you say, I want to start a business, they'll say, oh, that's really a good idea. So it is still the American dream. We are a country that was founded by immigrants who came across an ocean. Therefore, we're by nature entrepreneurial. I mean, you can leave your home, get in a ship, and go across an ocean. Nowadays, a plane. You're entrepreneurial by nature. So they are people who are vibrant. They want to start companies, but I think what government can do is help create resources for those who do want to create jobs.
Mm-hmm. You keep, and you mentioned this, bureaucracy, red tape. What are the things that stand in the way of people being able to start their own businesses, and how could government alleviate red tape? I've never known exactly what red tape means.
Well, red tape, and that's good. Everybody said, oh, we think regulations are horrible. Well, I would say, okay, you don't want regulations? Okay, try taking drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA, or try breathing air that doesn't meet certain qualities, or swimming in water that doesn't meet certain tests. Regulations are important. Nobody's, I don't believe in a regulation-free world would do anything good for the United States. But what government can do is, as what Bloomberg did in New York, is they have an incubator where anyone starting a business can meet government officials once a week who will help accelerate the permitting process. Hmm. So if you're going to start a restaurant or you have, you know, liquor license, whatever, these are long, drawn-out affairs. Well, if you could accelerate the permitting process, help people get their licenses quicker. In other words, it's built around the idea that the individual, get out of the individual's way, help them succeed. That's what we did at BizStarts. We're not there to drive companies. We're there to support people who want help in starting companies. And it is amazing. Well, here's the most important trend line, and this is happening below the radar. Our business leaders aren't seeing it. It's happening right here in Wisconsin. Right now, you could go back 5 or 6 years ago, and you'd see maybe 5,000 companies started a year in Wisconsin. And that seems like a lot.
It does.
Guess what's happened? Due to automation and layoffs of corporate America and our large industrial companies, today there are roughly 60,000 new businesses started in Wisconsin every year. Just
seriously?
In Wisconsin.
60,
going on 60,000.
Oh my gosh.
Right now. These are small LLCs. And why? So many of them are what we call accidental entrepreneurs. They have no choice. They've lost their good pay. Look at all these people in Carrier. I mean, listen to all their stories. What are they going to do now?
Right.
I mean, where are they going to go? So many people say, well, this is my chance. I might as well start a business. And it's never been easier because of the internet, because of cell phones, because of social media and everything else. Everything, even manufacturing with 3D printing. There are people going into business. It would have been a very hard slog a long time ago. And now it's much easier to start a business. And so you're seeing this explosion partly because of the technology that allows people to start businesses. If Kathleen Dunn starts tomorrow and go out to start her own little radio station, she can actually do it.
All right. Let's go.
There you go. Kathleen Dunn, the new entrepreneur. So it's easier to start it. And plus, people are losing those jobs that they once had. And they have no place else to go. So they're doing it.
Right. And of those 60,000 that are started this year in Wisconsin, how many will survive?
A lot will fail. I'll be honest about it. I mean, that's why I started BizStarts, because it's like, anything else, how do you succeed in business if you've never run a business before? So they come to BizStarts, and I say to your listening audience, if you're thinking about it, come to us. You can start online. And even if you're not and you want to help your fellow citizens start companies, you can come to us and you can get engaged at BizStarts. You can become a mentor if you've been in business and you want to help somebody else. You want to donate. You know, we're a 501c3. It's not going to cost you anything. But for our supporters, we all say, hey, go to our website and engage with us. If you want to make a cash contribution or a credit card, fine. $5 or $100. The more revenue we have, the more entrepreneurs we can help. We are overwhelmed with the number of entrepreneurs coming to us for help now. It's exciting. That's the good news. And the bad news is it's exciting and overwhelming. So these are people who are going to succeed. Most of them will succeed if we're there to help them every step of the way.
And when you talk about being able to teach creative thinking in schools, how do you go about doing that? Do you have a course in creative thinking?
Exactly.
You do.
I'll give an example. MIT, one of the great institutions of America, teaches entrepreneurship and creative thinking as part of their curriculum. Okay, what have MIT graduates done? Over the last 25 years, they have created several thousand companies. The MIT graduates who started companies are now responsible for well over $1 trillion of annual revenue in America today across the country. And only 10% of it has to do with technology coming out of MIT. They just started teaching entrepreneurship, teaching creative thinking. Creative thinking, and you know, the great thing about creative thinking is that whether it's a business or in your personal life, I know you moved recently. There's a process of deciding where you want to locate, defining the problem. How do you do ideation? How do you put multiple options in play? Then how do you test those options? How do you explore your ideas? And then how do you evaluate it? And then how do you select which way you go? Those are skills that can help our students, not just if they want to start a business, but just navigating life. we are moving to a world because of, we're all our own bosses now. We have access to tools we never dreamed of. But the creative thinking process and be able to creatively solve problems is an important skill our students need now. And there's where our education institutions are falling short, because they're not teaching that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can graduate, you can do math, you can do history, you can, you know, the arts, but do you know how to creatively solve the problems that you're going to meet in life? So, yeah, I drill it into the curriculum. We can teach it. MIT teaches it. And look at the results. So.
What about money, Dan? Doesn't it cost a lot of money to follow your dreams and start your own business?
Starting your own business isn't cheap. There's probably never been greater resources available. We've got, because of community banking and other requirements, it's easier to get loans now because they exist to help people start businesses. One of the most important things we work with in working with entrepreneurs is try to avoid the money trap. In other words, if you can teach people to start a business with as little resources as possible, I mean, try to prove that we have our entrepreneurs try to prove they can get customers before they launch their business. If you've got this great dream and you're really excited about it, okay, we're going to help you look for customers to see if there's a market, people who would pay for your dream. and the thought is, don't start it unless you can identify, it's called the lean startup methodology. Don't start that business unless you can identify 100 customers that you think are going to pay you for that service. Otherwise, stick to your day job or whatever. So our goal is to reduce the financial burden, because we don't want you walking away with a second mortgage on your house. We want you to test the market, see if you can be an entrepreneur, start a business. And most businesses have started that way. Most of the great businesses in this region, my grandfather was Daniel Hone of the Hone Bridge. Okay. My mother was his daughter. And I lived with Granddad when I was young.
Did you?
Sure. He was a very interesting character. But I remember my mother saying that they lived on 33rd and Kilburn. And she said the Davidson brothers lived across the alley, or really close to him. And she'd go over there and see them tinker around in their garage trying to put a motor on a bicycle. And she said, I never thought that made any sense. And I said, Mom, why don't you buy stock options? So all of our great companies started in people's garages, tinkering around. And every day we see entrepreneurs, and whether it's software, it's new manufacturing startups, ideas they've had. And we get them to the point that they've been able to test it, see if customers will pay for their service. And many times they come up with something that they may never be in business themselves, but they've created something, help them get a patent, and the larger companies will buy it. And so they'll license it. So now they have a stream of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans by nature are very creative, but now we're giving them an outlet. So
I still can't get over 60,000 new businesses
every year. This is all happening below.
Dumbfounding.
It's happening below the radar because all the stars, whether it's Google or Apple or Epic and Madison, you see these. Quadgraphics was a startup, so was Market Electronic. So we see the big stars. What we don't understand is that the vast majority of businesses today are small. They're family-owned businesses. They're one or two family members. They're providing a sustainable job for themselves,
mm-hmm.
to raise their family. And those jobs aren't going to go away. Where are we going to get our hair done? Where are we going to get our car washed?
Right.
You know, where are we going to eat? You can't do that on a computer. And so these jobs are going to still be here. So for the listeners out there that have thought, hey, maybe I should try it, start with our website. We even have a test there to see if you're entrepreneurial in nature, and you can test yourself.
Oh, do you?
Sure, yeah, you can go right online and do it. And then
how do you do this?
Just go to our website. You know, bizstarts.com, bizstarts.com. You can give yourself your own little test to see if you got your entrepreneurial in nature. But then if you say, I'm interested, you can apply right online. So once you're online, it's like going to the doctor. You come in, see Jacqueline Davids, our entrepreneur director. She's going to direct you. She's going to seem like a doctor. Okay, the first thing you need to do is talk to a mentor. Or, well, should I have a legal entity? Okay, we'll send you to a lawyer, and it's going to cost you anything because they're going to donate some time. Whether you should start an LLC, a corporation, do a sole proprietorship, you're going to get – it's going to be a one-stop shop for everything you need. And you do need a lot. Or maybe you're just at a point you really don't know. We'll send you to a boot camp. There's plenty at the technical colleges, a 3D boot camp, where you can 3 days learn all it takes to start a business. But remember, virtually every great company you think in this region, whether it's Harley Davidson, whether it's JCI, whether it's Falk, all the companies we've had, they started businesses in their garage. They started in their kitchen tables. And Northwestern Mutual, same thing. All of these companies started here locally, started with some entrepreneurs, said, hey, I think I can do something different. What everyone needs to ask themselves, do you see a problem that you think you can solve
mm-hmm.
by starting a business? And if you think you've got something, all right, come to us. That's why we exist, to help you. But, and same with the government. You know, they can be doing things, creating opportunities for citizens to get help who want to start businesses. Because I think if the presidential candidates were honest, they would tell the American people it'll never be the same again. Those high-paying, low-skill jobs are being automated away. Even if you go to Mexico or China, they're still going to have the same problem. What can they do to really create an infrastructure that helps support entrepreneurs? Another thing I suggested in the editorial, and this might fly over the radar of some of your listeners, but just very quickly to say that there's this world called private equity, and you've heard about it. Hedge funds, if you watched Wolf of Wall Street, or if you watched more recently The Big Short, these are firms that exist to buy companies for the most part. And they buy existing companies. So your dream as an entrepreneur is to grow your company. And along comes a private equity firm and says, okay, Kathleen, you've done a nice job. We're going to offer you $10 million for your company. And you'll say, oh, where do I sign? So now that's the good news. A lot of these private equity companies buy some of our biggest firms in the country. And you know what they do? They downsize the company. They eliminate jobs. They gussy up. And then they sell it 5 years later. So what I've suggested our presidential candidates could do is let's look at that tax code again. They get up what we call a carried interest. They get a nice bonus on the sale of the company, and that's treated with capital gains. Okay, fine. That encourages investment. I think the government could easily make that favorable tax treatment contingent on that company making sure that the company they purchased created more jobs. Why would you reward a business, private equity group, or a hedge fund that went in and bought an ongoing concern, downsized it, right, eliminated jobs, right, and then sold it so their investors can get rich? And likewise, and we hear a lot about Mexico and China and all the companies that are moving to Mexico. Look, a lot of that's inevitable, but I want to ask people when they say, you got to go to Mexico, the CEO say, oh, I have to do it to save labor. I say, okay, let me ask you something. You can go right down here to Lake Geneva and visit Kikkoman. Kikkoman is a Japanese company, came here about 15 years ago, the United States, no market share in soy sauce. They're now the number one soy sauce maker in the United States, all American workers. Then go down to Illinois, and I know you have some listeners in Illinois. Visit the Toyota plant in Illinois. Go to Indiana, visit the Honda plant or whatever Japanese. Go to Nissan. Go to Smyrna, Tennessee, where the Nissan plant is. See the Volkswagen plant, the Mercedes plant in these states. Aren't they making money with American workers right here in our backyard, and their cars work? Don't tell me you have to go abroad to make money for your shareholders.
Let's go to phone calls. We need to pause for a moment. We have a lot of people who want to speak with you already. We're talking about jobs and what's the best way in an economy that has changed so dramatically. Our guest has outlined how many people have been losing their jobs, corporations moving overseas, and has offered inspiration, I think, for those of you who would like to start your own business, as 60,000 people, places in the state of Wisconsin want to start their own business and do so every year in this state. That's just incredible, isn't it? Daniel Seininger is president of BizStarts, and they assist entrepreneurs in starting their own companies. He's the president of Seininger & Associates, helps employers identify innovative approaches to driving new revenues for their companies, and he's the author of a piece that caught our attention in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Presidential Politics and Jobs, a Reality Check. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Angie in Appleton, our first caller for you. Hi, Angie.
Hello. What I'm thinking as I'm listening to the show is an uncle who has been running a small business for the last maybe 20 years. What he had said to me is how when it comes to taxes and breaks, when it comes to starting a business, when you are so small, you almost have to take the brunt of the huge corporations, and that needs to be redone almost into like three very simplified classes so that we can help the smaller business person to begin. When people come to this country, they get loans and grants. We need to open that up to our own people so that we can take back America.
Angie, I'm voting for you for president. That does it. You know, you raise a very good point. Now, that's a very specific thing the government could be doing. If you're starting a business, the first 5 years, why should you be paying the corporate tax rate or whatever? Give entrepreneurs a corporate break, a tax break in the early years of their company. That would be one important thing our presidential candidates could be talking about. That's going to facilitate a lot of people taking the risk to start companies.
Thanks, Angie, for your call. We go to Jack in Dunn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I was wondering, there's that show on TV where these three or four people that have made a ton of money, they appear before them with your idea, and you try and get them to buy a piece of your company. Do you think that's pie in the sky? Does that encourage people to be entrepreneurs, or does that discourage people?
You know, he's talking about Shark Tank. Actually, BizStarts does a version of Shark Tank. I'd like to call it the Walleye Tank because we're more friendly. We actually do have forms. I think it's a great concept. What people don't know about is that Shark Tank takes a percentage of your revenues for the rest of your life. People don't talk about that. But nevertheless, we do an investor form, and we think your company's one that can scale and scale rapidly. We have what's called angel investors. People with high net worth are willing to take a risk on your company and invest in it. And you maybe sell 20-25% of your company, and it gives you equity capital. So if you fail and your business doesn't make it, you don't owe the money back. Mm. And yes, we do an investor forum quarterly for those companies we call gazelles. We think could be high growth, investors are interested. I mean, I'm holding up a cell phone. I mean, on this cell phone are apps like Yelp and apps like that. Somebody invested in that one point in time. Uber has investors. So if you've got an idea that might be scalable, that could really be something that would be attracted to customers. And when I say scalable, it has to be slightly different than a normal business. It's not going to be another restaurant or another hair salon. It's going to be something truly disruptive, something different than what we're used to, that we think would really scale quickly and reward investors who invest. Then we actually have an investor form for high net worth individuals who actually will put money. But we're friendly. We don't bark hard questions at you. We're there to help you succeed because we're putting money in your company, and we want you to succeed because then we get a return of our dollars. But yeah, it's a great idea, and I think I'm glad that show is out there, and I think it's got a lot. Everybody knows about it. Everybody wants to be that person standing up asking for capital with their great idea, and they do capitalize some very, very good ideas.
Mm. Have you a lot of great ideas in your life? Do you sit around thinking of great ideas, Daniel?
Well, I think, let's put it this way. All of us do the creative thinking.
We all do.
I ask everybody, where do you when you're sitting at work or in a classroom, are you having great ideas? No, you get great ideas when you're in your shower, you're going for a walk.
Right.
All of us have good ideas. We're hardwired to think creatively. And that's why I call my column Innovate or Die, because in fact, we're all around because our ancestors were creative enough to survive and do something to fight the elements of or wild animals or whatever they did. We all have to be creative or we wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
By nature, it's a normal. I just ask everybody, what's the most creative thing you've done in your life? And you've done it by five, and it's the most complex thing you'll ever do. I mean, what's that? You've learned to speak.
Right.
Your parents never bribed you. No one ever threatened you. If you didn't speak, you couldn't eat dinner. But you learned to speak, and you learned it because it's a creative exercise. It gave you an ability to communicate. Walking, who threatened you to learn to walk? But you did it. You did it because as a human being, you're innate. You want to do things creative. We're just hardwired to do it. And all these folks at Carrier Corporation have just been laid off. It isn't just about the money. It's about the chance to go to work and do something of significance.
Absolutely.
Every day of their lives.
Right.
So it's a natural human thing to want to be creative. We're there to help people unleash that creativity.
Mm. Thank you, Jack, very much for your call. Sarah in Waterford. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, actually it's Sandra.
Oh, hi, Sandra.
Hi, thanks for your show. Hey, Daniel, I developed a tiny little tool called the Hangaway Universal Toothbrush Holder, and I sell it on Amazon since 2000, and it's kind of grown into being one of the number one bestsellers. My question is, I'd like to get it into retail, but I think I have to go through a broker. Somebody who will take it under their wing along with other line items. Can you explain a little bit about
Well, that's, first of all, congratulations. You're exactly really? The kind of person I'm talking to. And your listening audience is like, why didn't we think of what she thought of? So, Sandra, first of all, just go online to BizStarts and apply online. You know, www.bizstarts.com and apply. You come in, and that's exactly what we'll hook you up with a mentor who's been in business, who understands. Our executive director will do that. We'll connect you to somebody who can help you. These are objective people. They're doing this because they love to help people. And so you'll get some good, savvy advice in one place where you don't have to worry if it's trustworthy or not. That's what we exist, to make sure people get an honest opinion. Because you know what's going to happen? You're going to find a lot of people who are going to say, oh, for $10,000, Sandra, I can get your product to market, and you're going to get so rich. Let me tell you, there are a lot of unethical people out there. And that's the sad part I've seen so often. So we're a 501c3 or nonprofit, and we're there to help people like yourself. But congratulations. You're
that's
exactly
great.
What we're talking about. How wonderful. Well, hope we see you. We'll help you out.
Thanks. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for your call. Sure. Let's go to Jed in Appleton. Hi, Jed.
Hi. This is a long-time listener, first-time caller. I believe this is more of a comment. I believe that if we had socialized medicine, that there would be a mass exodus of people out of their jobs starting businesses. I've been in business for over 25 years, and my biggest hurdle and biggest problem is healthcare. I've lost a major amount of money to having problems where I was covered, but I was, you know, high deductible. In fact, it was more than my wife made in a year, how much I had to pay yearly. So I think, you know, this is, it's a comment. I would like to hear what you think about that. And
well, Jed,
NFIB even came out in favor of it once. So,
I'll tell you, you really hit a very important point. I don't want to get political. First of all, you're in Appleton. It's a great town. The Bolt Company is up there. They're great people. I'll tell you, one of the frustrations they always have, it's healthcare. It's a high line item expense if you're a big business or if you're an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, the Chinese in many of the countries, India or Mexico, we're competing against them. They're not having to pay their employees healthcare costs. This is a big issue, and I'm not going to lobby for one thing or the other, but you're absolutely right. If we could take healthcare off the table, for whether big companies or little companies, and Canada has done it. Everyone complains, but I golf with Canadians. I know a lot of them. They love their one-payer system. So the government provides a floor for health care, takes it off the burden of your P&L statement as a business owner. So now you compete head-to-head. And as an entrepreneur, you wouldn't have to worry about it. Now, they offer, you know, insurance plans for those who want their own private insurance plan, fine. But at least if we had a health, we could take health care off the table for entrepreneurs, it's one less horrendous expense they'd have to face. So, Jed, you're absolutely right. It's something, there's where the government could really have an impact, because we're competing across the globe, whether it's China. I have clients, major clients, global clients, that are saying they can get, if they can compete now on wages with China, their problems is the cost of health care or pensions. Well, if we could take that off the table by giving a floor basic government plan for anybody, now your businesses could compete more, whether you're an entrepreneur or a large company. So, Jed, you're absolutely right. I'll vote for you for president.
Somebody should vote for you for president, maybe.
I had one politician in our family, Dan Hoehn. That's enough.
Yeah, he was an important one, too.
He
was. Tom in Manitowish Waters. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show today. Always great to hear when you're promoting doing business in Wisconsin. I come from a family. We started a business 47 years ago and grew it to 1,800 employees in this great state.
What do you do?
And we built manufacturing plastics company in Phillips, Wisconsin. And since then, we had sold, and I've done three more startups since. It gets in your blood. But and now I'm taking a little time off, helping my wife start her own art business. So, but I just wanted to touch on a few things. You guys cover a lot of the items. But Wisconsin is a great, great state. We don't talk about it enough to grow a company. We have great, great folks that are loyal, hardworking people.
Tom, I wish we could clone you, but I mean, obviously, thank you for what you did. You made 1,800 people over their lifetime very proud. They got to go to work because of your creative genius, and you what we call you is a serial entrepreneur. You've tasted, you've been successful, and now you want to be back in the game, and you should be. And lucky wife, she's got somebody like you. And you know what? what you are is a resource to people. That's what we try to do with entrepreneurs. And I'm sure when you started your company, you had some help along the way. We try to connect them to mentors who help them every inch of the way. So they have somebody to call to get help constantly, to get advice, get connections. So you're the kind of person we dream of helping our entrepreneurs because you've been in the game, you've been successful, and you love doing it. And boy, the kind of advice you can give to startup businesses is invaluable.
Thank you, Tom, very much. We should do a panel. This will be the beginning of another show. We'll have a couple people on the air with you, please, if you'll return, to talk about what we do to get people work, you know, in a completely changing economy, how it's changing, robots, et cetera, big companies moving. Sure, this is worth many more hours of conversation. Thank you, Daniel.
Sure can.
Yeah. And once again, give us the site again is bizstarts.com,
that's
right?
It. Engage with us anyway. You want to start a business, you want to get help in your existing business, or if you want to just be a mentor or help entrepreneurs or even donate, because we're like public radio. We make it by donations.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Dan. Dan Steininger, president of Biz Starts. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for doing on-air production, Chris Molina for producing this program. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour talking about how we got the primary system in this country.